From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. And here's what happened Wednesday.
Just days after receiving an experimental drug that hasn't been tested on humans, 42-year-old Thomas Eric Duncan lost his fight against Ebola.
He was the first person to be diagnosed in the United States, having traveled here from Liberia, reportedly after contact with an infected pregnant woman.
The CDC says it continues to monitor the 48 people who may have been in contact with Duncan while he was infectious.
Thomas Eric Duncan, a Liberian national, was the first person diagnosed with the virus in the U.S. Here, coverage of his case was relentless as international reporters thronged Duncan's residence and hospital, vying for information. The Dallas Morning News reported that police even heard rumors of journalists posing as pizza delivery guys and bribing residents to get into his apartment building. But for Liberia's local reporters, the stakes are much higher. Covering the country's biggest story could conceivably kill you. Rodney Sia is founder and editor of Front Page Africa, based in the capital Monrovia, an independent newspaper known for its investigations of corruption and human rights violations. He says that when Ebola began to take hold earlier this year, many Liberians believed the disease wasn't real.
There were no images of Ebola people dying. And so a lot of people felt that maybe the government was making this thing up. There was even a lawmaker who made a remark to say that the Ebola epidemic is a scheme by the government to make money. So it was very, very difficult for people to believe it.
How did you challenge that thinking?
Back in May, I called one of the assistant ministers of health and I told him, I said, look, you need to let us go on the front lines and take pictures of dead people, take pictures of burials, so people can know that this thing actually exists. The ministry agreed. So my newsroom editor, Wendy Williams, was the first person who went on the scene of a burial incident. And it became the first images of the crisis in our country.
You published an editorial in August titled SOS from Liberia, in which you condemned the failures of the Liberian government. You called on, quote, every international humanitarian organization to please intervene in Liberia before Africa's oldest republic loses its entire population. How did the government respond?
The president actually called me on that editorial, and I told her, I said, look, there was not enough quarantine being done. There was not contact tracing being done. We had done a story about a guy who took his friend who had symptoms of Ebola on his back. They walked about 6-7 miles from West Point to the hospital in JFK in Cinco. He actually put the guy down in front of the hospital, bleeding, vomiting, diarrhea, and he left the guy there and went back to West Point. Mm-hmm. So that's why the numbers keep going up.
But you suggest the government isn't just mismanaging the thing. It's trying to obscure what's going on and make it hard for journalists to do their job. Why that?
Too many negative stories are going out about the government. So they decide now who covers a health center. They decide now who goes to a burial. They decide now who goes to a hospital interview, a hospital doctor.
On Monday, the Liberian Press Union issued a statement saying the government has, quote, not only failed to implement domestic and international promises, but is now undermining the free press, censoring the media, and slipping into attitudes that led the country to more than 14 years of brutal civil war. Are you accusing the government of obsessing too much on the press and too little on the crisis itself?
If you look at the issues at hand, is the government doing enough to quarantine people so they don't spread the virus into other areas? Are they doing enough to provide protective gears for Ebola? They're not really addressing those issues, but they want to cut down free speech and right to walk freely and right to assemble. The president submitted a bill to this legislature on October 1st asking them for these powers. She wants the constitution suspended. In the midst of an Ebola crisis, the government is actually concerned about restricting free speech. The irony is just crazy.
How are you focusing your coverage? What's your primary aim?
Well, our aim is to make sure that we cover every aspect of this crisis. And one of the issues that's developing that's not getting a lot of coverage is the issue of the orphans. Mothers have died, fathers have died, so the kids are left all alone by themselves. There was a little girl. This is one of the most painful stories of this crisis. She must be about a year old. the whole house died from Ebola, and she was in this house all by herself with the mother's corpse. She was sucking on the breast of her dead mother for almost 5 days until the burial team came and picked her up from there. So it tells you the magnitude of this crisis.
Have any of your reporters been reluctant to cover the story?
Obviously, everyone's afraid of Ebola. But surprisingly, our reporters have been very strong and brave in this crisis. There was a case last week, a community called Barnesville, one of the most infested area for Ebola in Liberia. They were mobilizing people in the area to go from door to door and do temperature testing on people and see who has symptoms of Ebola. So I called one of my reporters up. This reporter didn't even hesitate. She followed the team from door to door, took pictures, interviewed people, and did a very nice article that really hit the nerves of people around here.
Have any of your reporters gotten sick?
No, we have not. Although we don't have the resources that other people have, our reporters can't afford to get protective gear. So we have to improvise at times. We've been very, very careful.
How do you and your colleagues deal with the reality that the story you have to cover could cost you your life?
That's the big challenge we face every day. We take those risks because getting the story out is very important. I mean, you win, you lose, you live and you die, and something got to kill us. But we're very careful with that saying that we put our life on the line to die for nothing. We know that we're doing something that in the long run will benefit the world. And we are at the forefront of this crisis. We need to let the world know what's happening in Liberia, and we're going to risk our lives doing it.
Do you have any theories as to why Ebola became an epidemic in Liberia?
The answer is very simple. Three things: quarantine, contact tracing, and lack of medical supplies. Nigeria, where a Liberian American took the virus to, managed to, as of 2 weeks ago, declare themselves Ebola free. You know how they did that? They did that by quarantining, they did that by containing, they did that by contact tracing. In Senegal, one case came from neighboring Guinea. That person was quarantined, contact traced, and nipped right away. In Liberia, we do not have that speed, that precision. And the CDC is saying that by January, if we don't do the things that we're supposed to do, this virus will hit 1.4 million cases. So you can bring in the United Nations Security Council, you can bring in the United States Congress, you can bring in the U.S. Defense Department on this territory, but as long as we don't have the quarantine measures in place, the containment measures in place, the contact tracing lockdown, we're all going to die in this country.
Rodney, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Rodney Sia is the founder and editor of Front Page Africa, an independent newspaper based in Monrovia, Liberia. Lenny Bernstein covers health for The Washington Post. After a 12-day reporting trip to Liberia in September, he wrote about the experience in a piece called Reporting on Ebola, First Rule is You Don't Touch Anyone. Lenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
We're talking early in the week. They're still watching to see if you're going to exhibit some symptoms?
The virus can incubate for 21 days, and I've been home 11. The last possible day I could have picked up Ebola was September 25th in Liberia. So just as a precaution, I'm avoiding crowds. I haven't been back to the office. I'm staying away from my wife and daughter. It's just an abundance of caution. I have no symptoms, and you can't hurt anyone when you don't have symptoms. You're not infectious.
Take me back to your decision to go to Monrovia.
I write a health blog for the Post, and we were following it and doing a lot of stories. And then a fellow on our staff went to Sierra Leone and reported from there. He's the first guy, very courageous guy, who went in. And then it became very clear that the story was moving to Liberia because the number of infections and deaths in Liberia was starting to outstrip the other two countries, Sierra Leone and Guinea. And so I volunteered.
I guess there was a lot of competition for that post, right?
I don't know if there was a lot. But we were between Africa correspondents, so they needed somebody.
Tell me about the reaction from your colleagues, your friends, your family.
Pretty much everybody here in the United States thought I was crazy. My parents were very upset. My friends were very upset. My wife, of course, had veto power over this, and she was concerned, but she said, yeah, I understand the pros and cons. You should go.
The advice you received from other journalists was quite different and pretty consistent. They said, follow a few rules and you'll be fine.
Don't touch people. Try not to touch your face. Make sure you have chlorine on you at all times to wash your hands and wash your shoes. Be careful where you go when you're near the sick in case they sneeze or they cough, or worst of all, if they vomit. And you're going to be fine.
But when you were in treatment centers, you couldn't touch anything, not even a wall, not a desk, not a piece of paper.
That's if you went inside a facility where you didn't know whether there were sick people or not. So the major treatment center run by Doctors Without Borders, they have fencing there that keeps you away from the sick and you're okay. Once I touched a trash can and they said, you know, wash your hands, but, you know, you were fine. But then another time I went into a small private hospital. It was pretty horrific. Dark and shabby, nothing that you would call a hospital here in the United States. And I didn't know who was in there. I didn't know whether there were Ebola patients there or they were just general medical patients there. You know, I didn't know if there was vaporized blood or other body fluids anywhere near me or on the walls that could harbor the virus even for an hour or two. So best rule there, don't touch anything.
Even if you're in the cleanest facility in the world, if the virus gets on a piece of paper or on a piece of cloth, and if the temperature is right, it can live for days.
Yes. The research on this is all over the map. Under ideal conditions, they have recovered virus from surfaces after, I think, 3 weeks. I'll tell you a story. When we were sitting in the office of Dr. Jerry Brown, he runs LWA2, which is the original Ebola treatment center. It's run by Liberians. Someone came in and handed him two slips of paper to ask his opinion on a patient who was out there. And he looked at what was written down, handed it back, and he immediately washed his hands. You know, it's just a really good precaution to take. Just don't touch, and if you do touch, wash your hands.
And that precaution you didn't anticipate would be so difficult. You wrote, I was goofing around with a small group of young children outside their home on a muddy, cratered road in the New Crawtown slum here. I made a scary face and the kids skittered, giggling. Finally, the boldest of the lot, a little girl perhaps 5 years old, approached and stuck out her hand. Shake, she offered excitedly. No touching, I responded, keeping my hands at my sides. No touching.
It's really sad, you know? I mean, if you walk down the street and there's a bunch of little kids there and you start playing with them, you're going to touch their head or, you know, shake if the kid wants to shake. You can't do that over there. You can't touch anybody. And it's very weird. Now, that's us Westerners. The Liberians, unfortunately, don't have that luxury because while their odds are still good, you know, we're only talking about thousands of infections among a population of 4.1 million people, they still are putting themselves at risk every day.
You wrote that they play a daily game of Russian roulette with their very lives. They press tightly together front to back at bus stop lines. They jostle at food distribution sites. They handle their own dead.
They have no choice. They live in very crowded conditions in the city, tiny little shanties with a lot of people squeezed in there. If one of those people has the infection, imagine trying to not touch that person who lives perhaps in the same room as you do.
From your experience reporting there, how would you assess the press coverage here?
I think the coverage has really brought home what is going on. Social media bothers me. The comments on stories are just crazy. You see a lot of racist stuff from people. And then one of the things that really bugged me was a Donald Trump tweet that said, we shouldn't let Kent Brantley back into the United States. He might bring the virus here. Kent Brantley was a physician and a missionary in Africa caring for sick Liberians. And he came down with the virus and they were racing him back here. He was very close to death. To say that we should not bring this fellow back into the United States and try to save his life when he was going to be in isolation the entire time, you know, that's just crazy. There's a lot of scared people out there, and they need to tune in to what the actual risk is and how that risk is being managed.
Would you go back?
Would I go back to Liberia? Like today?
Yeah?
Absolutely. It was a life-altering experience for me. I think the risk continues to be small, and it's a story that has got to be told until this gets under control. I'd go back there tonight.
Lenny, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Lenny Bernstein is a health reporter at the Washington Post. Coming up, how fictional narratives of Ebola affect the reality on the ground. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we watch the struggle to contain the Ebola epidemic in West Africa, the images from Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone look hauntingly familiar. Because they are. They're reflections of what author and professor Priscilla Wald calls the outbreak narrative. That's what we see when we hear the word Ebola.
Some of this looks like scenes out of a movie, of course, and there are a lot of questions about Ebola.
It's more reminiscent of a movie than it is reality. How has this spiraled out of control so quickly?
Our brains have evolved over time to consider the threats we can see, and we've all seen the images coming from the movies.
It's based on truth, but highly sensationalized, as in Richard Preston's 1994 bestseller, The Hot Zone. Here, he follows the path of an Ebola-like virus carried by a man called Charles Monnet.
A hot virus from the rainforest lives within a 24-hour plane flight from every city on Earth. All of the Earth's cities are connected by a web of airline routes. Once a virus hits the net, it can shoot anywhere in a day, wherever planes fly. Charles Monnet and the life form inside him had entered the net.
From there, it's just a quick leap to a terrified Tinseltown. Take the movie Outbreak from 1995.
If one of them's got it, then 10 of them have got it now. And if one of them gets out of Cedar Creek, we have a very interesting problem.
Or 2011's Contagion.
On day one, there were two people, and then four, and then 16. In 3 months, it's a billion. That's where we're headed.
Priscilla Wald, author of Contagious, Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative, explains the moment this particular variant of the narrative began.
The beginning of what I'm calling the outbreak narrative, the specific narrative about a hemorrhagic fever, about disease emergence, is 1989. And that was a conference sponsored by Rockefeller University and others, where a group of scientists and epidemiologists and one medical historian got together to consider the problem of what they then defined as disease emergence.
What sparked it?
What sparked it was HIV. And I think the reason that this was so significant was that in the late 70s, with the last naturally occurring case of smallpox, with the eradication of that, there was a sanguinity that was like, look at how we've advanced. Look at the progress we've made. Infectious disease is going to become a thing of the past. Ebola had appeared in the mid-70s, Bolivian hemorrhagic fever, hantavirus, but they were relatively well contained. And then we encountered HIV/AIDS, which was something that medical science couldn't understand, couldn't contain, truly a pandemic.
So how did this narrative emerge from this conference?
This group of scientists and doctors and so on said the problem here is development, that human beings are moving into places they've never been before, and they're encountering these microbes to which they are not immune. This is not just a medical problem, it's a social problem. And then their analysis of that problem got picked up by science writers, the mainstream media, and popular fiction and film.
Okay, so what is the basic plot of the modern outbreak narrative?
A new microbe is encountered and creates a new disease, something that liquefies organs and makes blood come out of all the orifices. And it happens in a jungle somewhere, but it quickly gets into the cities of the global world, and it becomes a species-threatening event. Ultimately, it is contained by modern science and medicine. The solution always comes from the U.S. The problem always comes from occasionally Asia, but almost always Africa. One of the features of an outbreak narrative is that it ends, that there is a resolution, and it's not as horrific and apocalyptic as everybody feared. Now, with Ebola, there's not a cure, but traditionally, the Ebola outbreak is extremely dramatic, but very quickly contained. I am still hopeful that now that we have paid attention, Ebola is certainly something to be respected, we, the world, will get it under control.
So Ebola is a perfect candidate for this narrative, and there are a lot of upsides. But ultimately, there is a substantial downside.
The outbreak narrative creates the possibility for stigmatizing of people as well as places, which has economic consequences and social consequences. It can make people do things that actually exacerbate the danger.
Like
being afraid to go to the emergency room when they're sick. You see that happening in Africa. A second problem is that it can make people complacent. Everyone is so used to Ebola being quickly contained that this one was allowed to get out of hand. But to me, the deepest problem of the outbreak narrative is that it perpetuates a crisis mentality. What we immediately go to is containment, thinking about pharmaceuticals and vaccines. But the greatest single vector to turn an outbreak into an epidemic is poverty. And when you see people living malnourished, not having adequate shelter, not having access to state-of-the-art healthcare, those are the things that really turn an outbreak into an epidemic into a pandemic. So my question is, why aren't we looking at the deeper problem? And I think the crisis mentality of the outbreak narrative is a contributing factor.
Okay, I'm going to stipulate that we are wired for narratives. The world is too complicated to understand as data sets. We create stories. So how would you change this one?
An outbreak narrative that would begin to get us at being able to address the problem would start before the first outbreak. And I'll give you a real-life example with thanks to Paul Farmer, medical doctor and anthropologist. 10 years before an outbreak in an impoverished section of Haiti, corporate interests in the United States and Haiti got together and built the Pellagre Dam. As a result, a once thriving subsistence farming community is now underwater. The farmers have had to move up the mountain where the land isn't arable. They have then moved from a sustainable lifestyle into poverty. It's a place that people talk about as disease-ridden and crime-ridden. Now we have the conditions for what we think of as the outbreak narrative, but we're telling the story very differently, and now we know where to begin to address the problem.
So at what point are we in the outbreak narrative? Would you say we're in the heroic struggle?
We are in the heroic struggle of the outbreak narrative. Witness the headlines. Words like apocalypse, CNN's comparison of Ebola to ISIS, as though ISIS is a bioterrorist itself. That's the evidence of an outbreak narrative.
Priscilla, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Priscilla Wald is professor of English and Women's Studies at Duke University and author of Contagious: Cultures, Carriers, and the Outbreak Narrative. You just heard Priscilla Wald refer to CNN's trenchant chyron, Ebola, the ISIS of biological agents. That inspired photographer and novelist Teju Cole to pen what amounts to a fever dream about what else cable news thinks Ebola might be. Cole wasn't able to read it for us, so we asked Slate's Mike Pesca.
This is CNN Breaking News.
Is Ebola the ISIS of biological agents? Is Ebola the Boko Haram of AIDS? Is Ebola the Al-Shabaab of dengue fever? Some say Ebola is the Milosevic of West Nile virus. Others say Ebola is the Ku Klux Klan of paper cuts. But at some point, the question must be asked whether Ebola isn't also the Narendra Modi of sleeping sickness. At first, there was, understandably, the suspicion that Ebola was the Hitler of apartheid, but now it's become abundantly clear that Ebola is actually the George W. Bush of being forced to listen to someone's podcast. Folks, this thing is serious. The World Health Organization calls it the Putin of Stalin. In layperson's terms, that's like saying it's the Stalin of U2. Now, we're seeing the idea thrown around that it could be the Black Hand of the Black Death, not to mention the Red Peril of the Red Plague. If you don't want to go that far, you have to admit that Ebola is the Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb of stage 4 brain cancer. At this point, it's very possible that Ebola could become airborne and turn into the Tea Party of extreme climate events. Look, I'm not the politically correct type, so I'm just going to put it out there. Ebola is the neo-Nazism of niggling knee injuries. The kind of threat it poses to the American way of life essentially makes it the North Korea of peanut allergies. I'm not going to lie to you, and I don't care what color you are. You could be green, red, purple, blue, whatever. You need to understand that Ebola, the Obama of Osama, but don't quote me, is literally the sum of my best friends are black of hashtag not all men. But the burning question no one has raised yet is whether Ebola is the Newsweek of halitosis. We'll get to the phones in a moment and take your calls on this. But first, let me open up the discussion to our panel and ask whether Ebola is merely the Fox News of explosive incontinence, or whether the situation is much worse than that, and Ebola is, in fact, the CNN of CNN.
Mike Pesca is the host of the Slate podcast, The Gist. Teju Cole is the author of Open City. And you can find this essay by him at NewYorker.com. Up next, do we pay too much attention to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, or just the wrong kind of attention? This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Now, a conversation with two journalists who have devoted much of their careers to reporting on Israel and Palestine, and who see the coverage of the conflict in notably different ways. This exchange was prompted by an essay that ran in Tablet magazine at the end of the summer on the heels of the war in Gaza. Titled, An Insider's Guide to the Most Important Story on Earth, it is an indictment of the Western media's treatment of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, penned by Jerusalem-based journalist Matty Friedman and drawn largely from his experience as a reporter and editor for the AP's Jerusalem Bureau from 2006 to 2011. He argues that the Western press is far too focused on the conflict and that its framing distorts our perception of Israel. The piece went viral, prompting a slew of raves as well as rebuttals, including two from Maddie's former editor at the AP in Jerusalem, Stephen Gutkin. But we didn't want to focus solely on the AP. So in our search for a reporter to counter his argument, we decided on New York Times deputy national editor Ethan Bronner, who covered Israel-Palestine in the 80s for Reuters, in the 90s for the Boston Globe, and for the Times as Jerusalem bureau chief from 2008 to 2012. I started by asking Ethan whether he thinks there's a disproportionate focus on Israel in the press. And then you'll hear from Maddie.
There's a very large coverage of Israel. The question of disproportionate is the more complicated one. One place in which I differ from what Matty wrote in his essay is I don't think that it is something that has been determined by the media. The United States gives $3 billion a year to Israel. My last summer, when I was correspondent there for The Times, 80 members of Congress came to Israel. Some of them, newly elected, had never had a passport before, had never been out of the country before. To them, foreign policy meant, what do you think about Israel? We, in the media, reflect the interest. I don't think we create it.
I think the question is a kind of chicken and egg question, and the question of whether the media should be following or leading. Reporters do have a role as educated observers of the world in explaining to readers or to viewers what is important. And the idea that reporters should just cover whatever people are interested in isn't one that will really hold up. There's a lot of interest in pornography, but the AP doesn't cover pornography. Educated people need to decide what's important. They need to look at a globe, speak to smart people, and decide which stories are important and how to cover them.
I don't think it's a fair analogy to compare it with an interest in pornography. I'm not saying people are interested. I'm saying that the United States government has focused on the Israel-Palestine issue with an extraordinary laser-like focus. And it is a bipartisan phenomenon. Now, why? Why is the United States so interested? First of all, it is the Holy Land. It's called that for a reason. It is holy to the three great monotheistic religions, okay? That's 2 billion Christians, 1.5 billion Muslims, and 14 million Jews. So that's almost half the world. So what happens there matters. It's also an amazing story, right? The near destruction of the Jews in the Holocaust, their rise from the ashes. The United States also has a very close relationship with Israel. There is a sense that this is a democratic outpost that needs to be preserved and yet needs to be pushed to do what the Americans consider right with regard to the Palestinians as well.
As for America's friendship with Israel, it's undeniable, of course. But for example, America has 30,000 servicemen in South Korea, and those are American citizens who are supposed to die to protect a foreign country from attack. And I would argue that that is a commitment exponentially more significant than the U.S. commitment to Israel. And yet, if there has been obsessive South Korea coverage, I've missed it. I think the friendship argument is true in part, but it's not enough to explain the phenomenon. There's certainly a huge amount of interest in this place because of its historical connotations, but the kind of coverage we're seeing here is not massive, a coverage of biblical archaeology or religion. What we're seeing is extremely critical coverage of the actions of the Israeli government, and I would argue that this interest in the Holy Land, I think that there's a very thin line between that and the development of a hostile obsession with the moral failings of Jews, which, as we know, is a very deep thought pattern in the West.
You have both made a distinction between the coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the European press and the American press. Ethan, how would you describe the difference? And then Maddie.
Broadly speaking, I would say that in the United States, coverage of Israel takes as a given that it is a legitimate country, that it has problems, that there are issues, that relations with its neighbors and with Palestinians need to be written about. But the core question of whether Israel is a legitimate country is not asked over and over. I would say that much of European coverage gets to the question of the legitimacy of Israel as a project from the beginning and questions it. I also would say that American media coverage of Israel tends to explore Israeli society, not necessarily all in a bad way, and take it seriously as a culture and as a society, and that's much less true in Europe.
I think Ethan's right. I think that there's more poisonous press coverage in Europe, but I think that the difference between American and European media has eroded. That's been my experience. I think that you have a press corps here, and it's a social group. People know each other. People move between the organizations. If we look at the Gaza coverage from this last summer, I don't think you'll see a lot of difference between coverage in the States and in Europe.
The truth is that the coverage I've seen most closely is that of the New York Times. I haven't examined that of others. But I would say that the New York Times coverage took the question of whether the victims were civilians or fighters quite seriously. The notion that Hamas operates from among civilian buildings and organizations was repeated frequently in the coverage. So it may be true that the locals who move between Reuters and AP are not very different. But I do think that the outlook of the organizations is different. A colleague of mine from Britain who came through who wanted to write a story about the evolution of the Hebrew language told me that his newspaper said, "We have no interest in this at all. You're there to cover the conflict." And that is never something that an editor here would tell a reporter in Israel.
I think the New York Times coverage of Gaza this summer was one-sided. We saw photographs of Israeli soldiers and Israeli tanks and dead Palestinian civilians. The story that Hamas wants to be told out of Gaza is that there are no Hamas fighters, that there is no Hamas strategy, and that all the dead are civilians. And that is the story that media organizations, including the New York Times, told this summer.
With regard to pictures of fighters in Gaza, first of all, I don't think it's true that Hamas would like the world to think that it doesn't have fighters. I'm certain that that's not the message they want to get out. What did happen in this war, as happened in the 08-09 and in 12, is that when the war begins, Hamas goes underground and they're actually impossible to find. When the journalists were crossing the border from Israel, there weren't even Hamas guys to stamp their passports as there typically are. The idea that journalists in Gaza were not taking pictures because they either didn't want to send the message that there were fighters or because they were afraid of the fighters, I think is a misunderstanding of what happens when you operate on the ground in Gaza in a conflict.
I think that that would be true if we didn't have examples of reporters who did.
We have very few, Maddie. We have like four because they're rare to find. It's not because everybody else is turning away from it.
I think one of the most striking images that came out of Gaza this summer was shot by an Indian TV crew, and you can find it on YouTube. They saw, in the middle of the day, a Hamas crew setting up a rocket outside their hotel. So how did these intrepid Indian journalists get this great footage?
They weren't intrepid. They were lucky.
If some of the 700, I think, reporters who arrived in Gaza to cover the conflict had their eyes perhaps a bit more open, we would have seen more images like that. But of course, the reporters are in Gaza to report a very simple story. They're reporting a story of Israeli aggression against civilians. So they won't show things that contradict that story, and they will accept the Hamas death toll and pass it on to their readers as fact, which the New York Times did too.
this idea that journalists in Gaza were unwilling to see that someone is shooting a rocket from next to you would turn away from it, I think is really a terrible thing to say about your colleagues. I have been there in those situations. What the Indian guy saw was a very unusual thing in the middle of the day of someone setting up a rocket and shooting it. Our guys didn't see it. Believe me, they would have taken pictures if they had. One last point I would say is that the Israelis had drones all over the place. And if you look on the IDF website to find examples of in the daytime rockets that you could take pictures of, you'll find one or two, but not dozens. It's very hard. In the 08-09 conflict, they didn't have a single one that they put up on their website. Not one.
Let's address one of your broader points, Maddie, that journalists there seem to adhere to a particular narrative about the conflict, a kind of master narrative. Can you describe it?
Sure. I like to think of it as the Israel story. And the story is that there's a conflict between a strong side, Israel, and a weak side, the Palestinians. And this is about the creation of a Palestinian state, what's called the two-state solution, which would happen if Israel wanted it to happen and which is not happening because Israel does not want it to happen. That's the framework for the story. And in that story, you insert whatever events happen on any particular day. Of course, that involves leaving a lot of stuff out.
There is some validity to that. That is the broad story of what's going on. But I never had an editor say to me, let's stick with the program, please.
But is it the space that you move in?
It seemed to me that my goal was, in fact, to challenge the strongly held convictions of both sides in this conflict. One side that believes the problem is that the Jews are simply never going to be accepted in any kind of state form in the Middle East. And the other side, the one that Matty has described, which is that the only problem there is the Palestinians need a state. And once they got a state, there'd be peace in the region. My feeling was that because those are such calcified narratives on both sides, that my job was always to try to challenge those perceptions with stories and details and narrative lines that would force people to say, well, maybe that's not exactly the case.
I'd just like to say, of course, that my essay involves generalizations. There are obviously superb reporters working in Israel, and one of them is on the line with us. I'm talking about a broad systemic problem that is larger than any individual journalist or organization.
And Maddie, you wrote that if you follow mainstream coverage, you'll find nearly no analysis of Palestinian society or ideologies, profiles of armed Palestinian groups, or investigations of Palestinian government. Palestinians, you said, are not taken seriously as agents of their own fate.
You can look at the press coverage over the past decade, probably more coming out of this place, and you'll see that the only agent here whose actions deserve analysis is Israel. Of course, there are small exceptions, but few. Palestinian society is very interesting. It's very fractured. Hamas is a very important, obviously, and interesting group. And these things are not subjected to anything like the amount of attention that Israeli policy and actions gets from reporters.
I think that one of the journalistic missions is to sort of cover the fight against power, the oppression that is inherent in power. So what Maddie says that, you know, you cover more of what's going on in Israel than among Palestinians, it's true. Part of it has to do with this idea that in the West Bank and in Gaza, while of course there are rulers in Gaza, the larger power is still over the situation is Israel. I wrote several stories about the way Hamas operated its judicial system, its efforts to increase the role of religion in life. But I think that generally the bigger question of the geopolitical one is still the more important one. Now, I agree that more coverage of Palestinian society would be wonderful. One of the problems is that as a foreign correspondent, you really don't create facts. You basically cream off facts that are produced locally. Israel is a society of enormous self-examination, an extraordinarily robust internal conversation about what's going on, and institutes and ministries that produce huge reams of data that allow you to report on it. That is simply not true in the West Bank and in Gaza. So your job is much harder to do in Palestine.
And Maddie, isn't it also partly, you say, because of Hamas intimidation of reporters?
reporters understand that there are things they cannot report. I document in the essay an incident in the 2008-2009 Gaza war, which our excellent, by the way, Palestinian reporter in Gaza reported a detail in the morning. The detail was that Hamas fighters were wearing civilian clothes and were also being counted as civilians in the death toll. He called a short time later and had us strike the detail from the story because the reporter's life was in danger. Much of the intimidation is not focused on Western representatives of media organizations, but rather on the Palestinian staffers who do most of the work of the international media in Gaza. And I think that if reporters are unable to transmit to their readers very important facts about the conflict, for example, Hamas strategy, Hamas use of civilian facilities, the existence of a Hamas headquarters underneath Gaza's biggest hospital, and you are not telling your readers that you are under threat and are censoring the information they're getting, you're committing a major ethical violation.
Yes, it's true that your stringer who lives there may be a little more cautious, but you're also saying that the 700 reporters who showed up for this war curbed what they wrote because they too were afraid of being hurt by Hamas officials. And I suspect that that's just not true at all. In the 4 years I was the bureau chief, I met with Hamas officials whenever I went there, and there was never a discussion of coverage. I'm not saying it doesn't exist at all, but I am saying it is a much smaller problem than the way Matty and generally the way Israelis view it.
I think this is the way it works. A foreign correspondent comes into Gaza and will suggest a story to the Palestinian staff that needs to make the story happen. The story might not happen for reasons that are not apparent to the reporter. For example, it's possible that the person he wanted to interview is unavailable. Hamas, which is an incredibly sophisticated organization, by the way, they understand that they have successfully co-opted the Western press corps already. They don't need to threaten you.
What about, and we hear this a lot, that there is a sense of lowered expectations for the Palestinian governing authorities than there is for Israeli governing authorities?
This is a very delicate and complicated question, but there is no question that the less advanced or developed a society, the sort of lower the expectations of a lack of corruption, of accountability, and so forth. So I think that is reflected in our coverage of Palestinian government, yes.
What that means when you don't cover what Hamas is, when you don't cover its ideology, it's a group like many others in the Middle East dedicated to the idea that radical Islam must extend its supremacy across the Middle East and confront the West. And its charter includes quotes from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. It accuses Jews of being behind the French Revolution, being behind the Russian Revolution, being behind both world wars. And when you don't cover Hamas's ideology, when you don't cover its militant apparatus, when you ignore for the past 3 years that Hamas has been building tunnels under civilian neighborhoods, that it's been storing rockets in UN schools and under mosques and under people's homes, when you don't cover that, then something happens like this war this summer. And everyone is blindsided, and it looks like an Israeli aggression against innocent people.
I mean, we have written about the charter in our newspaper, and it is a deeply troubling document, deeply troubling. Hamas ideology in that sense, the anti-Semitism that you do hear from their mouths is simply unbearable. I'm totally with Matty on that. On the other hand, having spent a lot of time talking to Hamas leaders and followers in my life, interestingly, it's not actually what they talk about, okay? So it's sort of a complicated thing. Not to me, you said?
That's right.
I don't think it's about what they say to me. There are whole industries devoted to listening to the horrors of what come out of Palestinian classrooms and broadcasts. And, you know, they're there, but it is not 90% of what comes out. It's 10% of what comes out. There is a difference between what Palestinian nationalists, whether they're with Hamas or whether they're with Fatah, what they want from this conflict, it's not the same thing as what the most radical Islamists want in the rest of the region. At least it hasn't been until now.
I think that one of the mistakes that Westerners make is not taking local people and their ideologies seriously. I take Hamas very seriously. I think they mean exactly what they say. And when their charter calls for the murder of Jews, I think they mean it. I don't think that they're secretly moderates with belligerent rhetoric. I think that radical Islam is very real. I live very close to it.
I'm not arguing that don't pay attention to them. I'm only arguing don't only pay attention to their radical anti-Semitic statements.
Maddie, you make another argument about framing. And you wrote, a knowledgeable observer of the Middle East cannot avoid the impression that the region is a volcano and that the lava is radical Islam, an ideology whose various incarnations are now shaping this part of the world. Israel is a tiny village on the slopes of that volcano.
I think one of the main problems in coverage is a lack of context. If you look at the history of this conflict, you will see a conflict that started about a century ago, before the state of Israel existed, before, of course, Israel occupied the territories of Gaza and the West Bank. So the idea that this is a conflict between Israelis and Palestinians is incorrect. And the idea that if the Israeli-Palestinian impasse is solved, there'll be peace in the region is incorrect. What the Israeli-Palestinian framing allows people to do is isolate 0.2% of the Arab world. That's the territory of Israel, in which Jews are the majority, and Arabs, Sunni Arabs, who are the vast majority in the Middle East, are a minority. And that's absurd. Jews here are 6 million people, outnumbered 60 to 1 by 300 million. That is the basic fact of Israeli existence. It explains some of the ugliness that is legitimately reported here. Societies that are threatened and at war sometimes behave in ways that are unpleasant. And all of that is lost when people pretend that this is about Israelis and Palestinians.
Well, I think that part of the problem is that what's happened over the last 3 years, the implosion of the Arab Middle East, has not been happening for the last 70 years. I mean, I have never argued that if the Israel-Palestine conflict could be somehow solved, that the rest of the region would radiate peace and well-being. Never have I suggested that. And I would say that what's happened over the last 3 years puts that idea out of the minds of many. But I can tell you that American governments have certainly believed that it is the key to stability in the region. There's no question that this administration came into office believing it.
What I'm saying is linked to that, which is that this country has to be covered in context. It's not a morality play. If I left my house in Jerusalem early in the morning, I could be in Aleppo by lunchtime and I'd be in Baghdad by dinner time. I think that the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria is not unconnected from the rise of Hamas in Gaza. And I think once we understand that Israel exists in a region and is dealing with the same things that other states in this region are dealing with, that'll go a long way toward solving the problem that I'm discussing.
I mean, one issue, though, with that perspective is it does absolve Israel of almost any responsibility for the forces that are arising among Palestinians of frustration and anger. And do you want to do that?
Absolutely not. And as a journalist here, I see it as one of my most important jobs to criticize the government and its policies, and I do that a lot. However, the idea that Israel faces a clear moral choice and is making the wrong choice, and that's an idea that underlies much of the press coverage, is completely wrong.
After any of these discussions, I always feel so serene. How about you guys?
I thought that was pretty serene.
Maddie Friedman is a Jerusalem-based journalist and former correspondent for the AP. His recent piece in Tablet is called An Insider's Guide to the Most Important Story on Earth. Maddie, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ethan Bronner is a former Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times and now currently deputy national editor for the paper. Ethan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Sarah Abdurrahman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, and Andrew Chug. We had more help from Kasia Mihailovic, and our show is edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Greg Rippin. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Katia. I have a special treat for you. We have a little podcast extra that Chris Neary, our fabulous producer, made. Okay, Brooke, take it away.
Last week on the show, I interviewed Craig Silverman about his new project called Emergent.info, a website that tracks rumors in real time as the media propagate them. But Silverman, who notes media errors in his long-running Regret the Error column, made an error himself in that segment. He talked to OTM producer Chris Neary about his regret.
At the end of the segment, Brooke and Craig were talking about how rumors can be dispelled. Craig explained that sometimes the best debunkings come from people outside the media.
Can you give me an example of that?
A really good example of that would be what happened when Barack Obama and John McCain were both running for president. There were, of course, you know, a persistent rumor, a persistent lie that Barack Obama was a Muslim. And at one of the events where John McCain was doing a town hall, a woman stood up and she described Barack Obama as a Muslim. And John McCain actually said to her very clearly that, no, he's not. He's a Christian.
Not long after the episode went down the podcast stream, commenter Jim Stites from Gatlinburg, Tennessee, pointed out that McCain never said Christian. Then, commenter Ed from NYC noted that that woman never called Obama a Muslim.
I can't trust Obama. I have read about him, and he's an Arab. He is not...
No, ma'am. He's a decent family man, citizen that I just happen to have disagreements with on fundamental issues, and that's what this campaign is all about. He's not. Thank you.
So Brooke and I were talking, and then she said, "Well, give me an example of that." My first reaction was, "Oh God, okay, let me think."
I Skype with Craig. He tweeted out a correction after the show.
And so that was the example that popped into my head. I didn't stop and say, okay, I think I have an example. Let me check it. I didn't say, give me a minute or two. Let me find something here. I think there was a little bit of pride and maybe a little bit of ego, because when I'm doing the interview and I'm being asked questions, I want to have answers.
Journalists explain their mistakes in different ways. A tight deadline, a bad source. You don't often hear pride. Later in the interview, Craig and I started talking about the 08 election.
Let me stop and look something up. So at one point, the Obama campaign had a website called Stop the Smears. And I can't remember if they launched that during the... let's see.
There's a reason why journalists don't like to sound like this. But this is the sound of accuracy.
Let's go back here. It looks like it was 2008. Okay. Okay, good. All right, so let me say it again. So in 2008, the Obama campaign launched a website called Stop the Smears.
The next morning, I Skyped Craig back. So yesterday, we were talking about the site that the Obama campaign set up, and you were saying that it was called Stop the Smears. I found that it's actually called Fight the Smears.
Fight the Smears. I'd even taken a second to look. Interesting.
So I'll just ask what I asked yesterday. Why do you think you made that error?
Wait, okay. So we're talking about the Obama one now? I've made so many mistakes. I can't even keep them straight anymore. One good piece of advice generally is when you're searching for something is to try and go past that first page of Google results. I'm just going to go punch myself in the face now, basically. All right.
For OTM, I'm Chris Neary.